it is going to be interacting with a system in the Bering Sea here in the next couple of days and swinging a pretty potent front up into the northern Gulf, which is where the rainfall and winds are going to come from.
A storm system heads toward Alaska's coast. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a legislative effort aimed at creating an Arctic port.
There are no deep water ports between Point Barrow and Unalaska. That's a stretch of coastline longer than from Tacoma to Long Beach.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
Russia has begun building military bases in its Arctic Far East. The independent English-language newspaper Moscow Times reported this week that ships have unloaded prefabricated buildings to create military installations on Russia's Wrangel Island and Cape Schmidt. Both are about 300 miles from Alaska's Point Hope. President Vladimir Putin this spring ordered the military to step up its presence in the region. He said last month he intends to provide security for shipping and pursue Russia's strategic interests in the Arctic within the limits of international law. Senator Lisa Murkowski in Canada this week for an Arctic conference issued a statement saying Russia's move isn't necessarily a precursor to future hostilities, but she says it's more evidence the U.S. is falling behind on building its own Arctic infrastructure as commercial activity in the region increases. She says the country may be heading for another Sputnik moment. This time, Murkowski warns the realization would be that we're not just behind Russia, but also behind countries like China and India that are already building icebreakers. A U.S. House subcommittee today considered a bill aimed at creating a deepwater dock at Point Spencer, a narrow curlicue of land on the Bering Strait, just south of the Arctic Circle. Alaska Congressman Don Young says his bill would divide the 2,000-acre spit among the Coast Guard, the state, and the Bering Strait Native Corporation, creating a partnership to build a port.
I want to move this legislation. I think it's badly needed for Alaska and for the nation. And, of course, it'll help Bering Straits out. There's no doubt about that.
Gail Schubert, CEO of the Regional Native Corporation, says the land transfer bill will protect cultural artifacts now vulnerable to looting. She also says developing Point Spencer will give residents the hope of employment.
We believe it could become a critically important economic engine in our region as the Arctic opens to commerce.
Kip Knutson, Governor Sean Parnell's representative in Washington, D.C., agrees the project is badly needed.
There are no deep water ports between Point Barrow and Unalaska. That's a stretch of coastline longer than from Tacoma to Long Beach. We need to redress that shortage.
But Knutson says the state objects to some of the bill's details, particularly how it divides the land. Knutson says, for example, that while the bill would give the state an airstrip, it doesn't provide enough adjacent land to operate it as an airport.
Our due diligence that we've invested in to date is telling us that a fragmented ownership of the land in the port development area is going to hinder efficient development and potentially slow down funding sources.
Congressman Young says he's open to changes and hopes to move the bill forward this year. A marine storm called an extratropical system is expected to bring rain and some wind to the coastal regions of western and south central Alaska later this week. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
First of all, this is not a tropical storm. It's an extratropical system. Michael Lawson is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service. He says this system started out as a typhoon in the western Pacific near Japan.
It is the remnants of a tropical system, but at this point it doesn't keep any of its tropical characteristics anymore and has made the transition to a colder core system as it comes up here.
It was still south of the western Aleutians Wednesday afternoon. Lawson says in gaining latitude and interacting with the jet stream, it's gotten a colder core, but it's still expected to bring some noticeable weather to the Aleutians, Kodiak, the Kenai Peninsula, and the Valdez-Cordova area.
It is going to be interacting with a system in the Bering Sea here in the next couple of days and swinging a pretty potent front up into the northern Gulf, which is where the rainfall and winds are going to come from.
He says over the next few days, it will continue to move eastward. It's expected to be south of Unalaska and Dutch Harbor Thursday afternoon.
And that's really when it's going to start interacting with the upper-level low pressure that's currently over the Bering Sea. And it will really start to develop as it moves northward. And that looks like it's going to happen overnight Thursday into Friday.
Lawson says the area around Unalaska, Cold Bay, and the Shumagin Islands may have some elevated winds. The heavy rains will likely fall on the Kenai Peninsula, but he says the real brunt of the blustery weather should happen over the water.
The main winds are going to be, gap-driven along Turnagain Arm, and there will be a little bit of a barrier jet along the North Gulf Coast, but for the most part, this should be over the water and not affecting places like Cordova or Valdez.
This extra tropical system is expected to cover such a large area that Lawson says the Panhandle will likely be the only southern coastal area that doesn't feel its effects. Residents of the Kenai Peninsula who live near the Kenai River watershed are still advised to keep an eye on rising water levels and secure any loose objects near the water. The Office of Emergency Management advises keeping weather radios handy and making sure they have batteries. Updates will be posted online at weather.gov/Anchorage. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, parents criticize the Juneau School District's punishments for hazing.
I think the efforts were a good step forward, but I think when the consequences were handed down, it was a step backwards.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above.
An oily sheen in Women's Bay has been traced to a NOAA research ship, Rainier, docked at Nyman Peninsula on the Kodiak Coast Guard base. According to NOAA Office of Marine and Aviation Operations spokesman David Hall in Silver Spring, Maryland, the spill volume was originally pegged at 400 gallons.
A mechanical malfunction aboard one of our hydrographic survey vessels, NOAA ship Rainier, resulted in the accidental discharge of about 400 gallons of diesel fuel into the water while it was tied up at the U.S. Coast Guard base in Kodiak, Alaska. We regret the incident and are working closely with the Coast Guard to minimize any environmental impacts and thank them for their assistance with the response. We're investigating the cause of the incident and are taking appropriate steps to ensure it does not happen again.
However, Jade Gamble of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation in Soldotna says the spill was actually 1,640 gallons. She said the spill was traced to a rupture in the bulkhead between a fuel tank and the gray water tank, which was not being used because the Rainier is connected to shore facilities. As the gray water tank filled with diesel, an evacuation pump would occasionally kick on, discharging the fuel directly into Women's Bay. Gamble says tracing the problem took all day yesterday. Absorbent boom and a fuel skimmer are working to clean up the spill, with a second skimmer being brought in to help. The spill was initially responded to by the Coast Guard, Gamble said, but responsibility will be turned over to NOAA, who is expected to hire a commercial cleanup company to mop up the contamination. The spill was first reported Monday to the Coast Guard and again at noon yesterday. Comments from locals on the Friends of Kodiak Facebook group reported the smell of diesel fuel coming from the direction of the base for several days. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has reached a settlement with Flint Hills Resources. The settlement, which includes an $80,000 civil penalty, is over Flint Hills' alleged mishandling of hazardous waste during groundwater cleanup actions at their North Pole Petroleum refinery. The EPA alleges that hazardous waste generated during the cleanup wasn't labeled or stored properly, which caused two preventable dumpster fires. The city of Seward will benefit from a $2.5 million federal grant that was announced yesterday. The U.S. Department of Transportation awarded the funds through its Transportation Investment Generating Economic Recovery, or TIGER, grant program. Ron Long, assistant city manager for Seward, says the city is a co-applicant with the Alaska Railroad for the funds. Long says the money will be used to complete a master plan for the railroad's freight dock expansion in Seward.
Good about it. We feel that some of the statements that we made in support of it were justified. It's an important part of our economy, and we're excited to see it move forward.
Long says it took about 3 years to secure the grant. The railroad owns and operates the dock. Tim Sullivan, spokesman for the Alaska Railroad, says the grant enables the railroad to determine what needs to be done to move forward with the expansion.
This is for the West Dock, which primarily serves passenger ships, and it's going to require major rehab or replacement in the next 10 years. And since it's nearing the end of its useful life, this is going to require some extensive planning activities that are included in this application.
Sullivan says planning is the first step, and further future construction will depend on future funding. The railroad owns 300 acres in Seward, and the dock is located on that land. The railroad does not pay any revenue to the city, but the city benefits from job opportunities for local residents. As part of a national effort to curb risky drinking habits and prevent fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention awarded grants to six universities across the country, including the University of Alaska Anchorage. APRN's Josh Edge has more.
Fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, or FASD, spans a wide range of physical, mental, behavioral, and learning disabilities caused by alcohol use during pregnancy. This isn't the first grant the University of Alaska Anchorage's Center for Behavioral Health Research and Services has received for FASD-related work. For the past several years, they have been training health professionals in FASD prevention and treatment. The new $1.1 million grant will be distributed over 4 years and will go toward establishing a fetal alcohol spectrum disorders practice and implementation center. UAA's Dr. Diane King says the grant will allow the center to help develop new strategies for the identification and treatment of FASDs.
We'll be working with experts in Oregon and Washington, as well as Alaska, and national professional organizations to really start to implement and help healthcare providers adopt more routine screening for alcohol misuse, counseling and intervention for women of childbearing age.
King says UAA's history in FASD training and research likely played a part in why the university received the grant, but she also says Alaska has a lot of momentum surrounding the issue.
There's a lot of concern about FASDs. It's pervasive here. There's a lot of women who are still drinking while they're pregnant, that somehow the educational messages are insufficient. And so really working together with healthcare providers is a way of doing that. And there was a lot of interest and support in Alaska for taking that approach.
The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services estimates about 163 children born in Alaska each year are affected by prenatal alcohol exposure. And studies estimate the lifetime cost of FASD could be upwards of $2 million per person. King says the center's training efforts have been slowly catching on, and healthcare providers play a vital role in the prevention and diagnosis of FASDs.
I think the opportunity for them to make an impact is huge in this way, and research shows that it's effective. If a provider is routinely screening and providing an effective, brief advice or intervention that we do see reductions, meaningful reductions in drinking.
The University of California, San Diego, University of Missouri, University of Nevada, Baylor University, and the University of Wisconsin-Madison also receive grant funds from the CDC's National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
A regional committee tasked with advising the National Forest Service on how to manage logging in the Tongass began 3 days of meetings in Juneau today. The committee's work is part of a years-long process to rewrite the federal rules for what can and cannot be done in the Tongass National Forest. Last year, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack laid out a goal of phasing out old-growth logging in favor of young growth in 10 to 15 years. He said the transition supports ecologic, social, and economic sustainability in the forest. The Tongass Advisory Committee's recommendations are due in May. They'll inform a rewrite of the Forest Service land use plans for the Tongass that's expected in 2016. Members of the public criticized how the Juneau School District handled a hazing incident in May that involved 7 seniors paddling 6 incoming freshmen. During yesterday's school board meeting, they said the perceived punishment of the offenders wasn't harsh enough. Meanwhile, a state education official commended the district for trying to change the culture of hazing. From Member Station KTOO in Juneau, Lisa Fu has more.
Education Commissioner Mike Hanley said he's heard about hazing in Juneau schools for years. He thanked the district for tackling the problem.
I think the first step that you've taken is really a great one, to say this isn't acceptable. That's the message. I don't want to know who the children are that are involved. I don't want to know what the punishment are. I don't have an idea that vengeance, we need, you know, an eye for an eye. That's not it. We just need it to stop.
Hanley said the district's actions have sent this message, but added the administration and board can't carry it alone.
Coaches are the next ones that have more influence on our children and our athletes than any of us do. And they have that ability to continue to carry this message and own the responsibility we have to change the culture.
When the Juneau School District concluded its investigation into the paddling at the end of August, it held a press conference and identified the number of students who committed the violations and the number of victims, but did not release names or specific punishment due to students' privacy rights. Superintendent Mark Miller noted that 4 of the 7 paddlers were athletes. A couple days later, the Juneau Empire reported the names of the athletes and their punishment. The Empire wrote that penalties included a 1-week suspension from school, a 1-game suspension, and 40 hours of community service. Miller did not confirm or deny this. During public comment at the school board meeting, parent Graham Story said he was furious when he read about the punishment and said it was a horrible message to send to students.
The perception is that our students can engage in bullying and hazing with minimal consequence. Athletes who bully should not be athletes in this district. They should not have the privilege to participate when they engage in these actions.
Lynn Van Kirk said she's friends with a parent of one of the hazing victims.
He's afraid to do anything. He's afraid to go out with his friends to the football games, any type of activities. He did not go to the dance at JD because he was scared.
Jim Bradley is a parent of a victim and said the punishment of 1-week school suspension and 1-game suspension was not enough.
I think the efforts were a good step forward, but I think when the consequences were handed down, it was a step backwards.
Student representative from Thunder Mountain High School, Donya Herman, said the students have heard a similar version of the punishment and some think the senior hazers who are athletes should be suspended from sports for the whole season. Donya doesn't agree with that.
Sports are good for students. Student athletes are better students. So I think that they need to stay in their sport, but the punishment should have been greater to make a statement, at least to the community, that hazing is not okay.
Superintendent Miller said the district followed its rules and policies when coming up with a disciplinary action. He did reveal that the punishment included out-of-school suspension and community service.
I think we kind of hit a middle ground. I'm sure there are people on both sides of this that believe that either we did too much or we didn't do enough. And I've heard from both of those populations. I understand that and just feel at this point we did what we thought was right and are moving on.
Miller said in the next few weeks, the district will have a meeting with all the coaches about the hazing bullying policy and the proper way to talk about it to the public and media. He noted a possibility of longer-term training. He said the district also plans to implement an anti-hazing, anti-bullying restorative justice program. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska health officials have confirmed the first case of mumps in the state since 1995. The disease was confirmed in a 50-year-old Alaska woman who apparently contracted mumps in Japan. Fewer than 500 people in the nation contract mumps annually. Mumps is a communicable virus, but preventable by vaccine. Complications can cause meningitis, encephalitis, and deafness. The woman on July 11th told doctors she had headache, jaw pain, and trismus, a symptom that can mean jaw muscle spasms or locking. The woman, while in Japan, stayed in a home where a girl had been diagnosed with mumps. The Alaska section of epidemiology says the woman's symptoms began to subside about a week after she reported them.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Public employees Local 71 asks you to slow down in construction zones while they work to keep roads safe. Public employees Local 71 working hard for Alaska. Alaska laborers and the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities also know the importance of safe driving in construction zones. This message sponsored by Public Employees Local 71.
Federal authorities believe the death of a whale near Kodiak in July was likely due to a collision with the state ferry Kennecott. There were questions around the time of the incident about whether the animal was already dead when the ship struck it. Julie Spiegel, a spokeswoman with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, said that doesn't appear to be the case. She says the whale was freshly dead when examined. A necropsy found the cause of death to be a fractured skull due to a ship strike. She says there were no findings in the report that the animal was injured before the collision. Spiegel says charges will not be pursued in the case because the ship strike was unintentional and there was no evidence of a violation. Alaskans will find out the size of their permanent fund dividends next week. Governor Sean Parnell is set to announce the amount on September 17th in Anchorage. Dividends are distributed annually to Alaska residents who meet certain requirements, with the amount based on a five-year average of the Alaska Permanent Fund's investment earnings. Last year, dividend recipients each received $900. State transportation officials have announced a new project that could improve the commute from Eagle River to Anchorage. Shannon McCarthy, a spokeswoman for the State Department of Transportation, says construction starts this week on a project to widen the Glen Highway between Highland Road and Artillery Road in Eagle River. The stretch of highway includes the infamous Brake Light Hill and the Eagle River Bridge.
This project is exciting because it will build a whole new section of highway, extending the three-lane section for an additional 3 miles. That will help the steep grade at Eagle River, which is also known as Brake Light Hill, and it will actually build a whole new bridge over Eagle River. So there will be pretty minimal impacts to traffic this winter.
The existing bridge will handle highway traffic during construction of the expansion project. McCarthy says bridge work is better done in winter because water levels are lower. McCarthy says tree clearing for the extra lanes will be the first step. The $42.5 million project is being paid for with state money.
This is all state money, which is why we were able to turn the project around in just a little over a year. A lot of times federal aid projects take a little bit longer, sometimes 5 to 7 years. So this is exciting for DOT, and I think that you'll be seeing more of this as money allows.
The project is the first phase of a long-range improvement plan to increase Glen Highway traffic capacity. About 52,000 vehicles use the Glen Highway every day, and the stretch between Anchorage and the suburban community of Eagle River is often congested at peak commute hours. DOT officials say driver frustration contributes to vehicle crashes. McCarthy says the highway improvement project should be finished by spring of next year. The state ferry system is planning a new route in southeast Alaska. It's being done in conjunction with a new privately run ferry. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The new route will link unused ferry terminals south of Petersburg and on north-central Prince of Wales Island. Alaska Marine Highway General Manager Captain John Falvey says it will begin next spring when the summer 2015 schedule takes effect.
We're going to do some runs once a month to Petersburg, Salt Mikoff, and Kaufman Cove. We want to start using the Kaufman Cove and Salt Mikoff terminals a little bit.
The ferry docks were built last decade for routes that no longer exist. One sent a fast state ferry between Ketchikan and South Mitkoff, about 25 road miles from Petersburg. The other was an Inter-Island Ferry Authority route connecting Kaufman Cove, Wrangell, and South Mitkoff. More than $15 million in federal transportation funds paid for construction, but officials say the money needs to be paid back unless the terminals are used. Falvey says that's a reason for the new route.
We want to take a look at it and give it an honest try.
He says the small ferry Leconte will make a monthly trip on that route. As a result, Hoona will lose a sailing from Juneau. The Leconte will not stop in Wrangell, which is between Petersburg and Kaufman Cove. Also, the Petersburg and South Mitkoff stops duplicate each other, since South Mitkoff was built for access to Petersburg.
It's necessary to show that the terminals built with federal money are being used for their intended purpose.
Kent Miller is manager of the North End Ferry Authority. That's the group preparing a used 65-foot landing craft to sail along a similar route. The authority expects what it's calling the Rainforest Islander to dock elsewhere at the start, but it hopes to adapt the Mitkoff and Kaufman terminals for its use, and that requires them to remain in state hands.
We intend to start service in spring of 2015, nominally April 15th, and continue the service year-round.
The Kaufman Cove-based ferry will sail to Wrangell and the South Mitkoff Terminal 4 days a week. A shuttle van will bring passengers to and from Craig, Prince of Wales Island's largest city. It will also take riders the 25 miles from South Mitkoff to and from Petersburg.
Our service will have to pay for itself out of the fare box, and our financial analysis says that it can do that.
The North End and state ferry systems are working together to avoid conflicts. Both support each other's plans. The state's route is part of a proposed summer 2015 schedule just released for public comment. A teleconference is scheduled for September 25th. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Jeremy Shea and Lisa Fu, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson Project, proving energy lives here. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.